So today, I hope to finish this introduction to the combinatorics of diagrammatic of the perturbative expansion in the case of the 5-4 theory. And then I'll start to discuss a bit of the physics contained in this quantity, the Green's function, the correlation function, and start to discuss the issue of renormalization. Okay, so first, perturbation theory, the quantum effective action. So what we did last time is that I defined through a Legendre transform out of the generating function for all correlation functions of the theory, I constructed an object which is called the quantum effective action, which is a functional of a classical field, which is called the background field. So it's a classical, field configuration, which acts as a source term for the connected correlation, for the, I'm sorry, the one particle irreducible correlation function. So I made two statements. First, that this is the generating function functional for the one particle irreducible correlation functions of the theory. And the second statement was an explicit form for this to first order in perturbation theory. So the claim is that this is a classical action and then the first radiative correction, so the first quantum correction to the classical action, which are proportional to h bar. H bar is parameter expansion. This is just one half of the log of a determinant, or if you prefer, the trace of an operator, which is the log of the second variation, the Hessian of the classical action. So this is Hessian operator, namely the second functional derivative matrix of the classical action. And then you have higher order corrections, which have smaller in h bar. So if this is true, if this is generating functional for the one particle irreducible function, and if this is the first order quantum correction, this should contain all the one loop. So this should be equal to the sum of one loop, one particle irreducible diagrams. So first today, in order to make some explicit calculation, I'm going to show this by an explicit calculation in the case of 5-4 to the 4. And then I'll give an outline of why this formula is true. Okay, so first I'm going to do the explicit calculation for the 5-4 theory. So for the 5-4 theory, the classical action for a classical field is just integral d Higgs, one half. And let me write by integration by part, assuming that I'm in a periodic, for instance, space-time. I can write this as phi times, so which means phi of x, times the Laplace operator plus m squared. This is a differential operator, apply on phi of x. Okay, so this is a kinetic term. I have just used integration by part. And then I get the coupling constant divided by factorial 4 times phi of x squared. Okay? So this is a classical action. So what is this Hessian operator? This Hessian operator S of phi. So this is an operator which has a kernel. So its kernel is a function, let's say, of x and y, of x1, of x and y. Okay, so this is, I'm going to consider the kernel of the Hessian. Okay, so this is just the second derivative with respect to phi, functional derivative of the classical action. So this is just delta squared of s of phi divided by a variation with respect to phi at a point x and phi at a point y. Okay, so this is, the first term is quadratic. So this is just, the second derivative is just the kernel of this operator, which is a differential operator. So this is just, we can write this formally as minus delta x plus m squared applied to the kernel of phi of x times phi of x, which is just the distribution delta of x minus y. Okay, so this is a Dirac distribution. And I take this, I apply this operator to delta of x minus y. Yeah? And so this is also a distribution. Yeah? And then the second term here is, of course, this functional derivative is non-zero only if x equals y, because this is a local term. So this is delta of x minus y. And then you take the second derivative of phi to the 4, which is, of course, 6 times phi. I'm sorry, this is phi 4. So this is 12 times phi squared. So I get g divided by 2 times phi square of x. So this is a kernel of this object. Okay. So it's a differential operator times the function. But the function phi squared. And you see that this kernel, this differential operator, depends on phi. But in a very simple way. So these are just the rules of functional derivation. So let's just write this as, so implicitly there are delta function times, this is just, so basically S as an operator is just minus Laplacian plus m squared plus g divided by 2 pi squared. This is just a shortened notation for this object. This is a differential operator, and this is an operator which is multiplication by phi squared, which is a classical function. Okay. So now we have to consider, what does it mean to take the trace of the log of this operator? So this is, in fact, a local operator. It's a differential operator that depends on the function. So this is a second order. This is a differential operator. And in some sense, it is local. Local in x. Now, if you take the log of this operator, this is not going to be local anymore. Okay? But we can compute it in the following way. Okay. So let's rewrite this as simply, let's factor out this. So let's write this as minus the Laplacian plus m squared times, well, the operator identity. So let me write this one. The operator identity is the operator whose kernel is just delta of x minus y. And then, of course, what I get is plus the inverse of this operator. So let me write this as 1 over minus delta plus m squared. So this is an operator times the operator g over 2 phi squared, which is a multiplication by the operator x. Okay. And now let's take the log of this operator. And moreover, let's take the trace of the log. The trace of the log is just the log of a determinant. And the determinant of a product of two operators, let's assume that everything works out as if we were with finite size matrices. This is the product of the determinant. Okay, so if we are a bit naive, we say that this is just because if this is the log of a product of determinant, that the sum of the log of the determinant, so it's the sum of the trace of the log of this operator times this operator. So I can rewrite this with a bit of assumption as a trace of the log of this operator, the differential operator minus the Laplacian plus m squared, plus the trace of the log of this operator, 1 plus g divided by 2 times the operator, the inverse of this differential operator, times this differential of this operator. So this is an operator multiplication by phi squared. This is the operator which is the inverse of the Laplacian, plus m squared. And this is the operator identity. And then I close this. And in doing this, I've just assumed that, use the fact that for finite dimensional this trace of log of AB is just log of determinant of AB, which is a log of determinant of A times determinant of B, which is log of determinant of A plus log of determinant of B. The only things I'm assuming, of course. So here, the only delicate point is that instead of dealing with finite dimensional matrices, I'm dealing with infinite dimensional matrices, namely operators, differential operators or pseudo-differential operators. So, but that, let's assume that it works. Okay. So first, there is this term, which is just the trace of the log of this operator for the free theory. That's something that's related to the free field. So, and this is something that refers to the interacting theory. So let's concentrate on this second term. On this second term, now but and only at that stage we can make a perturbative expansion. Because then we have the trace of the log of the identity operator plus something small. So now let us expand, so make a series expansion. In G of this second term, this one. We just have to use the expansion of the log. We just have to use the fact that the log of 1 plus something is something minus this to the power square. So we can write this as the coupling constant. In coupling constant. So we can rewrite this object as this term is sum from k equal 1 to infinity. I don't pay attention to whether this is going to be a convergent series, etc. Just doing a formal perturbation expansion. I get minus 1 to the power k minus 1 divided by k. G divided by 2 to the power k times the product of this operator. So I'm going to have trace of the products of k times this operator that I can write as 1 over minus delta plus m squared times phi squared times 1 over minus delta plus m squared times phi squared. So I multiply a series of operators up to the last one. Okay, and I have each of these terms of k times k products of this. Okay, so that's as long as we don't care about whether this makes sense or not. Wait, this is just algebra, very simple algebra. Okay, but now we have to think in terms of what are these objects in terms of kernels. So if I have an operator, or if I have an operator, so in terms of kernels, but in terms of kernels. Trace class, what's called trace class operator. If I have an operator A, whose kernel is A of x, y, then what is the trace? The trace of A is just integral d dx of A of x, x. That's the definition of a trace class operator. And that's just the extension to trace class operator of the definition of the trace for a matrix. It's the sum of the diagonal element. Okay. And now, what is the product of two operators? The products of two, if I consider the products of two operators and I'm considering the kernel of the products of the two operators, this is just the convolution of the two operators. So this is integral d dy of a of x y times b y z. And this is just the generalization of the fact that the product of two matrix is the sum of the indices of the rows of the first, of the columns of the first matrix times the rows of the second matrix. Just extension of kernel of trace class operators. Just the extension of what we know for finite matrices. Okay, so now we know what is the kernel of phi squared. The kernel of phi squared is the kernel of phi squared of x, y is just phi square of x times delta of x minus y. So this function at point x times this delta distribution. Now, what is the kernel of this operator? The kernel of this operator, 1 over minus delta plus m squared of xy, we know what this is because this is something we have studied. This is last week. This is just the free field propagator. So this is g naught of x minus y, which is the functional, which is a Fourier transform, 2 pi d, well, let's call it a right k, ei k times x minus y, divided by k squared plus m squared. So this is the free field propagator. Okay. And so, if you combine this, you end up with an integral over some position. So we can write this. Let's write this in a, let's be a bit careful. This is just the kernel of this operator. So we get g naught. This is, we get a g naught of x1 minus y1 times phi squared of y1 times delta of y1 minus x2. So if x1, y0 are the variable of the kernel of this, y1 and x2 are the variation of this, x2 and y2, etc. g0 of x2 minus y2, phi squared of y2, delta of y2 minus x3, etc. And at the end, you end up with phi squared of the last y, which is yk. If I have k products. And then, of course, this is the delta of yk minus x1. Okay, this trace, this term. Is just equal to this. Okay? So I did everything carefully. So this is my second blackboard. This is my first blackboard. And of course, and of course you have to integrate over all the x1. D of x1, dd of y1, up to the last one. Because you have to integrate for the trace and you have to integrate for the product. Okay, but you have a lot of delta function. So finally, what do we get? Finally, this object here is just the an integral over n points, because you can get rid of the integrals over y naught. And so finally, we get that this big trace is just so this blackboard, the trace log of 1 plus sub, is just sum over k, which is a series expansion, minus 1 to the power k minus 1, g divided by 2 to the power k, divided by k, times integral dx1 up to dxk of g0 of x1 minus x2, phi squared of x2, g0 of x2 minus x3, phi squared of x3, up to g0 of xk minus x1, phi squared of x1. So we get an integral over the position, a product of phi squared at the different points, and then a product of propagator. But this product of propagator can be rewritten as a Feynman diagram. So you can rewrite this using the Feynman diagrammatic rules as a sum over k minus 1 to the power k minus 1 divided by k, g over 2 to the power k. And then what do we have? We have a first propagator that goes from x1 to x2. So this is x1, this is x2. And I integrate. Then I have integral from x2 to x3. Then I have integral to x3 to x4, etc., up to the last one, xk, which goes there. So I have a one loop and a diagram. Okay. But to each x are attached 2 phi squared. So I can represent this as a truncated line. And at this truncated line is attached a phi and a phi. Etc. You see? So this is a one loop diagram. These two truncated lines at each vertex. With 2 phi of x attached to the truncated line. So this is just the diagrammatic representation. I'm sorry, this picture is a bit messy because I'm mixing the integral. So this is just the diagrammatic representation of this integral. Just the same object. This is the object written explicitly in terms of products of propagator. And this is this object represented in terms of diagram. And remember, a line is just a propagator. And if you remember what I explained, but very briefly last time, an amputated or truncated line represent just delta of x minus 1. Okay, so you see that this is nothing but the sum of the contribution of all the one loop diagram of the 5-4 theory. Because each vertex has 4 legs. two truncated or amputated legs and two physical legs make the loop. So this is diagram of the 5-4 theory, as we expected. Okay. So everything works fine. And finally, you have this factor 1/2. Everything. So this is the sum of all the on-loop, all the one-loop diagram. Okay. So now let me just before discussing the final result, discuss a bit just what is this first term, the term for the trace of the log of the free field. The trace of the log of this operator. So this is log of this operator. Okay. This is just integral over d dx of x log of minus delta plus m squared x. I apply the same rule. So you may wonder what this is. But this operator, we know what its eigenvalue and its eigenvector are. Its eigenvalues are just the denominator of the propagator, k squared plus m squared. So, in fact, it's easy to see that the standard calculation, that the trace of the log can be rewritten as an integral d dx, because we have this. And this, you re-express it in terms of the momentum eigenfunction, of the eigenfunction of this operator instead of the position operator. And what you get is integral d dk over 2 pi to the power g times log of k squared plus m squared. Okay. So it's an integral. We have an integral over the whole space-time, and then an integral over k of this number. Of course, this is a bit divergent at large k, but if we close our eyes, this is an amplitude which is not very different from the amplitude of a loop diagram here, where there is a momentum k, we are going to discuss that later, which circulates around the loop. And so, let me just write this as another Feynman diagram, which is minus the closed loop . So imagine that you have a propagator which is closed unto itself, but which has no end, no beginning and no end. Okay. And okay. And so you can represent, this is just a diagrammatic representation, but it's also a one-loop diagram like those ones. And there is I put a minus sign for some consistency reason. Okay, and then you see that final result. The one loop term of the quantum effective action the quantum effective action. This is h bar. And this is Well, the first term is minus 1/2 of this closed diagram, is the contribution of the free theory. And then I have the first one loop diagram, which is k equal 1. So k equal 1, we get 1 over 1, g over 2. And in fact, I have g over 4, because I have a factor of 4 here, so I get g over 4 times the one loop diagram, which is this diagram. So this is a diagram we have seen already many times, but with an amputated phi and phi. Then we get the second order term, which is k equal 2, so we get a minus g divided by, there is a 1 over 2, g over 2 squared, and a 1/2, so this is a g over 16, I'm sorry, this is g squared over 16, and then we have this diagram, with 2 phi, 4 phi attached. Okay, and this goes on, plus g cube, and then we have 1 over 3 times 8, 3 times 16, which is 1 over 48. Times this diagram, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5, etc. Okay. We get the sum over in the diagram. And now, if you take, for instance, if you are interested in the two-point irreducible function, you can you take two derivatives with respect to the 2 phi, and you get a g over 2 times this diagram, which is the correct symmetry factor. So these are the correct symmetry factors for the one-particle irreducible diagrams. Okay? So we are done. This explicit calculation shows that this very compact formula, in fact, is the compact formula to write the sum of all one-loop, one-particle irreducible diagrams. Okay, so this takes some time because I wanted to be precise, but this shows that this works. So now, let me just, so this was the first point. Second point, I'm going to be just very short because I want to discuss a bit of normalization too. Let me discuss how do we prove this, how to derive this compact expression by path integrals, by this, using functional integrals. So this requires just some path integral calculation using the saddle point approximation. Remember how we defined the quantum effective action. The quantum effective action has been defined formally as the Legendre transform of the generating functional for the connected function. This is one particle irreducible. This is a connected correlation function. Therefore, as W of G equals 8 bar times the log of Z of G with Z of G equals the functional integral over field configuration, so random variable of exponential of 1 over h bar minus 1 over h bar times s of phi minus g dot phi. Okay. And the relation between this background field, this is the background field. Background field. And this is the source. Is that phi is defined as the functional derivative of W of G with respect to G. And the opposite, and you have the opposite is true. And remember here, phi is a random variable that we integrate over. So this is represent the quantum field. This is a classical field. Okay. So this is a general formalism. So now we are interested in computing the classical, well, the quantum effective action when h bar is very small, because we are doing an experiment. So if we consider that h bar is small, positive, we have to look for the maximum of this, therefore the minimum of this. So we just look to the saddle point approximation, which is the minimum, which is the minimum of s of phi minus g phi. Okay. And remember, s of phi is the action for the phi 4 field, and g phi means simply the integral. Remember, g times phi means integral over dx of g of x phi of x, and the same for phi phi. Okay. So what is this minimum? The minimum, let's call it phi c. C for critical, the critical point of this functional, or for call in French. Saddle means call in French. So this phi critical, of course, is given by solution of the minimal expression of this. So the variation of delta s over delta phi of phi minus g equals zero. So this means, in terms of equation, that you take the variation of this at some point, g of x, this has to be equal for all x, and this gives you the value of phi c. And of course, this means that phi c is a functional, this is a function, so phi c is a collection of the value of phi c at all points of x, but it is a functional of g, functional of the source term. Okay? And for phi 4, for instance, for phi 4, theory, it means that it's just a solution of the equation of motion for phi to the 4. Of x plus g divided by 6 phi c of x squared equal g of x. So you solve this equation, which is a nonlinear equation with the second term, and you get phi c of x, which depends on g. Okay. Okay. So now, and okay, I'm going to write this equation more in a more compact way. Remember, this is the second derivative, this is the first derivative of S. So I am going to write this as S prime phi C equal G. Just a compact way to write this. This is the gradient of the first derivative of the action under a variation of phi c equal g. Okay, so this is just the same equation than this. So this defines this equation, give you phi c as a function of g. Okay, so now we have the saddle point. Of course, what we would like to do is to expand around the saddle point. So this is the equation for the saddle point. Okay, so now we expand around the saddle point. So we write that a general phi here, we integrate over phi, so we write that phi equal phi c plus some fluctuating part. So this is a classical solution, and this is a quantum. This represents the quantum. This is a random variable. So it represents the quantum fluctuation around this classical solution. Okay. So if we expand, this was just this. If we expand this in terms of phi tilde, the first order term in phi tilde vanishes because of the equation of motion. So we can write z of g as, well, we can get out the classical term, so you can write this as exponential of minus 1 over h bar s of phi c minus g times phi c. So this is a functional of g, because phi c depends on g. And then we have an integral over d phi tilde of exponential of, and we, when we expand, the first term is minus 1 over h bar the second derivative of this. So the second derivative of this, the first derivative contains g but disappear, and the second derivative contains only the second derivative of s. So this can be rewritten as minus 1 half of phi tilde times the second derivative of the action at phi c times phi tilde plus higher order terms. Okay, so is this clear? Sorry, I have to. So this is the essence of the saddle point approximation. We keep the quadratic variation. So this is an operator which has a kernel. We computed it here. And so this means the integral of phi tilde of x times the kernel times phi tilde of y. That's a compact way to write this. Okay, and you see that because you have exponential of 1 over h bar, basically the fluctuation of phi tilde are of order square root of h bar. See that the phi tilde are of order h bar 1/2. The phi tilde of order 1, the exponential is exponential minus 1 over h bar, so this is exponentially small. And therefore, those higher order terms correspond to higher order terms in h bar. So we can rewrite this big object simply as the determinant of the Hessian at phi c to the power minus 1/2. Okay? That's the idea. Plus some term of order h bar that we neglect. So we have this big determinant. Okay, so now we are almost done. Because now we have z of g, so we can take the log. And what is the log of w of g? The log of w of g is minus s of phi c minus g phi c. W of g is, remember there is an h bar and there is a 1 over h bar, so that's g times phi c, which is a functional of g, minus the classical action of phi c, which is a functional of g, and then minus h bar over 2. And we have the log of a determinant, which is a trace of the log, trace of the log of the kernel, so the log of the operator, which is the Hessian of the classical action, evaluated by phi c. Okay, but remember, phi c is a functional of g. So this is this with phi c given by phi c obtained by the equation s prime of phi c equal g. Okay. So now we have to perform the Legendre transform. So we have to compute the background field. Remember, the background field is a functional derivative of W divided by G. And W of G depends on G through two terms, this one and the fact that phi c depends on G. So the explicit derivative, the complete derivative of W with respect to G is the sum of two terms, the partial derivative of this with respect to g, which is phi c. Okay. And then the partial derivative of this with respect to phi c times, well, the derivative of this with respect to phi c times the partial derivative of phi c with respect to g. So this is plus delta phi c with respect to g times this, which is g minus s prime of phi c, plus this times the partial derivative of this with respect to phi c, but this is a term of order h bar. But this is zero by definition. So you see that phi, the background field, is phi c, which is a function of g. This is zero, plus some term of order h bar. This is a crucial point. So you see that at the classical level, the background field is the same thing than the saddle point configuration, the critical value for the field. So at the classical level, we know the relation between phi and phi c. And for instance, what we have to do is you have to solve this equation. We know what is phi c, so we know what is the relation between g and the background field. And you see that the relation between g and the background field is quite simple, because it's g equals some local functional of phi c. So this explains why you can invert, relation. So now we have just to invert and perform. Invert, consider that g is a functional of the background field phi, given by this equation, and perform the Legendre transform. Okay. So the Legendre transform means that gamma of phi is g times phi, var phi, g, g, minus w of g. Okay? So this is g times phi minus var phi minus phi c. Plus s phi c plus h bar over 2 times trace of the log of this, the Hessian of phi at phi c, plus term of order h bar squared. Okay. So we are almost done, because we know that phi is equal to phi c. We know that phi c is almost equal to phi. So just a bit delicate, and since I've almost, I would like to look, so I just leave you as an exercise. Check that using this, using phi equal, so the background field equals the critical value of the field, the saddle point, plus some correction. This vanishes. So this can be replaced by s, the action of phi. And check that this can be replaced by trace log of the second derivative of the background field. This is easy, because this is already a term of order h bar. This requires a bit of work, but very little. And so finally, so you can, this means that basically in this equation, you can replace phi c by the background field var phi, and then this disappears, and this becomes s of var phi. So we end up with what we wanted to have. The effective action in terms of the background field, considered as a functional of the background field, is just the classical action for the background field configuration plus h bar over 2 trace of the log of the second derivative of, considered as a functional of phi phi plus 4 of h bar, which is what I claimed. Okay? And you see that in this derivation, the explicit form of the action S of phi do not never appear, never plays a role. So this is a result which is general. The only thing that we have used is the fact that phi is a real variable. It's valid for any scalar field. Okay.
Question?
Yes.
So why in W of J is it not minus J dot phi c? You're taking just log of z, right?
What? I'm sorry?
And you have W of J equals J dot phi c? Yeah.
Yes.
And I don't see why there should be a minus there.
There's a minus on those branches.
No. Because W of g is proportional to log of z.
Yeah.
And the log of z.
Oh, I see.
This is the log of the exponential, so it's minus s plus g phi.
Oh, okay, sorry.
There's a minus here. And then there's a minus sign. So that's just, there's minus and minus, so that you have, in fact, exponential times g phi. And when you take a functional derivative respect to g, you get a phi and not a minus. So this is the idea. Okay? Okay. So I'm not going to discuss more this combinatorics. Of course, if you are a bit curious, you might ask, what's happening at the next order? And why, as I stated, do the term of order h bar squared, they should correspond to two loop irreducible Feynman diagrams. And in fact, you can continue this kind of derivation. Get that the second order term is given by what corresponds in a general theory in terms of two loop irreducible diagram, but then it starts to be a bit messy. Okay, so I'm done with the perturbation theory, I think. And now let's turn to the real stuff, which is the structure of the Feynman integrals, or the integrals and the amplitude which are associated with the diagrams, and their ultraviolet divergence, singularity. So this is going to be just an introduction to a normalization theory. Okay. Okay, so we have seen already in the one loop expansion of the phi 4 theory that we have two diagrams that we met on Friday and yesterday, today, which is this diagram, this Feynman diagram, which we represent. In fact, it appears both in the irreducible function and in the function. So if you consider this is a part of the one-point function. And these diagrams usually denoted the tadpole diagram, because it looks like a tadpole with two little legs. So that's a standard denomination. Okay. And we have this diagram. So this tadpole diagram, in fact, corresponds to the expectation value of phi squared of zero in the free theory. Okay. So this is infinite, but if we go in a Fourier transform, so if we represent the propagator, or if we consider that the propagator here, which is integral d dk over 2 pi squared to the power d ei k x minus y, which correspond to the expectation value of phi of x, phi of y in the free theory. We can take its Fourier transform, the Fourier transform of this function, which corresponds to the expectation value of the Fourier transform of two field operators. We'll define the field operator here, phi hat. Okay, that's just integral d dx e minus I k x times phi of x. So by conditional invariance, there is 2 pi d delta of k1 plus k2 times 1 over k1 squared plus m squared. This is just the Fourier transform of this propagator considered as a function of x and y. So up to this conservation of momentum, conservation of the momenta, you have the standard representation of the propagator in momentum space, where you have the momentum k1 entering this end of the propagator, the momentum k2 entering through this propagator. You have the conservation of momenta, so the momentum here should be equal, so the entering momenta, ingoing momenta should be equal to the outgoing momenta here, namely minus the incoming momentum here. This represents the 2 pi delta of k1 plus k2. So this is, that's what I represent. And therefore, I associate this, if I have k goes to k, this is 1 over k squared plus m squared, which is the usual representation of the Feynman propagator. So, in Euclidean space, so k squared, the sum over mu of k mu squared. So I'm still working in the Euclidean, going from the Euclidean to the Minkowski space, real time, physical time formalism is straightforward in the calculation by using, well, almost straightforward by doing a Vick rotation. So I'm going still to consider the Euclidean space. So I'm still in the Euclidean. Theory. But the problem of the ultraviolet singularity is common to the Euclidean theory and the theory in Minkowski spacetime, so the relativistic theory. So, problem, ultraviolet singularities, common. Euclidean and Minkowski spacetime theories. Okay, so these are the usual Feynman rules that you have met. And to end up the discussion of the Feynman rules, the vertex, interaction vertex, which corresponds to representing a phi 4 of x. So you can view this as this represents a phi 4 of x. That you can view phi 4 of x1, phi of x1, phi of x2, phi of x3, phi of x4, delta of x2 minus x1, delta of x3 minus x1, delta of x4 minus x1. So that's an involved way to represent a vertex at point x. If you go to Fourier transform, this is going to be a phi hat of k1, phi hat of k2, phi hat of k3, phi hat of k4, and if I integrate over x1, times 2 pi to the power g, delta of k1 plus k2 plus k3 plus k4. The Fourier transform of integral over the x1, this one, this. So, in the Feynman representation in momentum space, you have incoming momenta k1, k2, k3, and k4. You have this delta function momentum conservation, which states that the sum has to be equal to zero, and except for this, there is a g factor associated to each vertex. So those are the Feynman rules that you have met already in QFT1. Okay, so once we have seen that, what should I do? This is my sixth blackboard. Well, I think I can forget about this. So. Let me, I can erase everything here. Oops. Well, I would prefer to erase this. Then this Feynman diagram, the amplitude associated to this tadpole diagram here, is just integral ddk, ddk divided by 2 pi to the power d times 1 over k squared plus n squared, which is divergent, ultraviolet divergent, k, and k goes to infinity. Okay, so this is the ultraviolet divergence that we have been discussing already at the level of the free field. Okay, but so let me write this, some function t of m, which for the moment is infinite. Okay. Now, similarly, what is this diagram? this diagram. And if we have some truncated or amputated external line with momentum K1, well, let's write it P1, P2. So the momentum are coming through there. P3, P4. So this is some Feynman amplitude, which in momentum in position space are just a product of two propagators. So this is G0 of x1 minus x2 squared, which seems finite, traveled finite, but it's Fourier transform. It's ultraviolet divergent too, well, sometimes. Because when you apply my rules of perturbative expansion for computing Feynman integrals, so I have, as I have said, conservation of momenta here, conservation of momenta here. So I can say that if I have a momentum attached to this propagator, K, on this propagator, I have a momentum which is P, P plus K, with P equal P1 plus P2, which is the incoming momentum on the left. And of course, it is equal to the outcoming momentum on the right, because P1 plus P2 plus P3 plus P4 has to be equal to zero. Okay. So up to the conservation of momenta, the Fourier transform of this object is an object I'm going to call B of P. It's going to function, be a function of M. Okay, and I'm going to call this the bubble diagram. Well, this is a tadpole diagram. Okay, and according to our rules, this is the product of this propagator times this propagator. So this is 1 over K squared plus M squared times 1 over P plus K squared plus M squared. Remember, K and P are d-dimensional momenta. And I integrate over the internal momentum, which is flowing through this loop. Okay, so that's very standard. You have met already this, I think. And you can check that you get this by the Fourier transform of this object. If not, I can do it. But okay. So this is a function of the mass. This is a function of the outgoing momentum. And this integral can be also singular at momentum. So this could be ultraviolet divergent when k goes to infinity. Okay. So when is this diagram, this tadpole diagram, and when is this bubble diagram ultraviolet divergent? This is divergent here, of course, when the dimension is larger or equal to 2. That's something that we have discussed at length. So this is when d is larger or equal to 2. So in 2 dimensions, it's logarithmically divergent. In 3 dimensions, it's linearly divergent, etc. And here you have a d2k divided by, you have 1 over k squared, and when k is large, 1 over k squared. So this is 1 over k to the 4, a large dimension. So this is ultraviolet divergent when the dimension of space-time is larger or equal to 4. So this is the difference between this diagram and this diagram. Okay? Important difference. Okay. So now, well, this is still just pure math. So now the question is, what does this correspond to, and what does this correspond to in the physical theory? So let's go back to the effective action. Okay, in the effective action, let's consider the 2-point one particle irreducible function. Which means the effective action at order pi squared. So the effective action at order phi squared, remember, this is the classical action of the phi 4 theory at order phi squared. So this is so if I define the function 2 as the functional derivative with respect to 2 phi at phi equals 0, this is a quantum effective action. What do I get? I get minus delta plus m squared, this is this operator, plus g over 2 times phi squared, but that's at phi equals 0, so this term disappears. And then plus h bar, and I take the second derivative, I add a 1 over 4, so this h bar, g over 2, times this diagram. Computated action. Okay, so this is the irreducible 2-point function. But what does this mean? This is a 2-point function, so this is a function of 2 positions. So this is a kernel. This is gamma 2 of z1, z2. And this is the kernel of this operator. Plus, so this is minus delta plus m squared times delta of z1 minus z2. And the Laplacian with respect to z1, for instance. And then this is h bar g over 2 times this diagram, which is t of m, times delta of z1 minus z2. Okay, so this is in real space, position space, the irreducible 2-point function. Now, take a Fourier transform to work in the momentum space. We just take the ordinary, and we get the irreducible function trend, which is now a function of 2 external momenta, P1 and P2. So these are the conjugate momenta to Z1 and Z2. And of course, the Fourier transform of a delta function is just a conservation momentum, so you get 2 pi to the power d delta of P1 plus P2, the same than the thing that we got there, true. And then that factorized, and then we get the Fourier transform of this, which is P squared 1 plus M squared. This is just the Fourier transform of minus the Laplacian is the square of the momentum. M squared is just M squared. And then we get plus H bar g over 2 times t of m. And then we get higher order correction. Okay, so this is the irreducible 2-point function. and there is a simple consequence that I'm not going to explain. I don't have time. A simple property. It's a two-point function, which is that now if we consider the connected two-point function, which we can call the G. Called W2. That's what I call W2, which is the second derivative of the generating function W with respect to phi phi, and which corresponds to, if I have Z1 and Z2, this is just the expectation value of the connected value of phi of Z1, phi of Z2. In the interacting theory, by Fourier transform, you get W2 of P1 and P2, which is 2 pi to the power d, delta of P1 plus P2 times some function of P1, which is a propagator, the full propagator. The propagator is just 1 over the inverse of this object, gamma 2 of P1. If I get rid of the P1 and P2, and write that this is the irreducible two-point function. So in momentum space, of the one particle irreducible two-point function in momentum space. This is also a very general property, which has a simple diagrammatic representation. Okay. So, and maybe tomorrow I'll explain a bit why this is true. But assuming that this is correct, then what I am just going to explain is that this means that the propagator of the interacting theory is just +7, 8. So this means simply that the propagator, the full propagator, the interacting theory with an incoming momentum P is just 1 over this function, which is P squared plus M squared plus G over 2. Well, there is this factor H bar, but in fact, it's a function of G H bar times T of M, this divergent function. Okay, plus higher order terms. So you see that, in fact, this is a number and this is a number. So this corresponds just to change the mass of the theory, the mass of the particle of the theory. So in fact, this means that this function, this W of 2 of P, has a pole now at P squared equal minus M squared plus G over 2 H bar T of M. Instead of P squared equal minus M squared in the free theory. Okay. And this means that, in fact, this corresponds to the physical mass of the quanta of the interacting theory. So, in fact, m squared plus g 1/2 h bar t of m equal m physical squared, the physical mass of the one particle excitation of the 5-4 theory. Okay? If you define the fact that the physical mass is just the first pole, position of the first pole in P squared. Okay? And this follows, for instance, from the Chalen Lehmann representation of the two-point function that we have seen in QFT1. And okay, if you are a bit worried about the fact that that's a pole of p squared equal minus m squared, remember that we are in Euclidean space. So k squared is k0 squared plus the spatial momentum squared going to Minkowski by a weak rotation means that we replace k0 by minus I energy. So we get that. Well, this is K Oppe's equation that if we have a pole at K squared, so K Euclidean squared equal minus M squared as a pole, means that the energy squared equal K squared plus M squared, which is a correct dispersion relation for a particle with mass M. So this is why there is a minus here. There's a minus because we are in the Euclid. Okay. So this means that in this diagram we might have some problem, but we have to remember that we are trying to compute a theory where the physical mass of the theory is given by this equation. So this means that this diagram represents the radiative correction to the mass, exactly by the same mechanism as the radiative correction to the mass of the electron in QED. You have seen in QED, you have seen that the propagator for the electron is given by this Dirac propagator. And then you have a first radiative correction, which is given by the fact that the electron emits a virtual photon. So that's a self-energy diagram for the electron. And this is a the mass electron. Well, in QED, there is also radiative correction to the wave function, but I'm not going to discuss that. Okay. So in the same way, in the 5-4, we have this propagator, and then we have this propagator, which is the radiative the mass, the equivalent of the Klein-Gordon boson. Exactly the same mechanism. Okay. So this is a radiative correction to the mass. As expected in any quantum theory, you have radiative correction. Okay, so next, tomorrow, I'm going to discuss how we make sense of this by discussing in more detail what are these divergence. I'm going to discuss also this divergence and show that similarly these diagrams, so this corresponds to mass. This is going to be correspond to the coupling constant. So we are going to see that this corresponds to the radiative correction to the coupling constant in the same way that in QED, you know, the interaction vertex corresponds to radiative correction of the charge. Yes?
We use the term radiative correction in a lot of contexts. What is the precise definition of a radiative correction?
Well, a radiative correction in my language is something very naive and simple. It's just the contribution of the one-loop diagrams and then of the two-loop diagrams. Because they represent contribution of the quanta that radiates out of the particles and interact with the other particle. So here we have a theory where we have bosons. They interact because they are quanta of a Klein-Gordon field, but they are interacting because two bosons interact by a contact interaction. And therefore, you have quantum or radiative correction by radiation quanta of the field to the classical process.
So is it equivalent to every time we have a loop, it's a relative correction, or is there are subtleties?
I think that's what I mean by that. Maybe the language is more involved. What, Dan, what do you think?
I agree with
you. Yeah, okay. So in my mind, when I'm going to speak about radiative correction, I mean, you know, quantum correction at one loop, two loop, etc. A quantum correction to the classical process. Okay? That's it. Nothing more. Okay, so I'm going to discuss that. I'm going to discuss what's the role of what's called the regularization process. So for instance, if you put the theory on the lattice or you change the high energy behavior of the theory, you have discussed that already in the QE. Quantum theory one course, I think. So I'm going to discuss in much more precise detail the structure of this effect and how a normalization comes into account tomorrow. Okay, but that's it. I stopped there. Okay, thank you.